thank the speakers for sort of the range of insights, which have covered, well, an awful lot of ground. I mean, to use a phrase that that Marnie Sanweis used in her book, Print the Legend, it's very much about photography in history and through history, if I use that phrase correctly, and how certainly photographs, I mean, some of the issues that, of course, were raised were how photographs are circulated and shaped, you know, our popular perceptions and popular opinion, both in the past and in the present. The changing meanings through history, certainly, in that carte de visite itself that Tony showed, and questions of authenticity, as well as the language. What is the language of photography, both in the past and in the present? What are people seeing? And Mala's, of course, about the use of photography and propaganda as propaganda, and also this interesting question about the confusions of race and both sympathy and threat in the images. And Deb's discussion of black soldiers, the sort of visibility and invisibility of black soldiers in photography. So, which is, you know, a horrendous simplification of what each of you said, but I just wanted to touch on a few of the themes. What I wanted to do was to dig a little deeper in some of the things that you had raised. And maybe we can just start off. And then, you know, everybody should jump in on this. But just beginning with what Deb was discussing with in terms of black soldiers, I was very struck when you were talking about the distinctions between, I guess you could say, public pictures versus private pictures or photographs taken for public purposes. And those private, particularly thinking of Frederick Douglass, is very, you know, clear awareness about this, you know, before the Civil War, and I wondered what your thoughts were about whether there were tensions about this, if indeed were, for example, the private photographs something that was circulated after the war, in other words, more about the legacy of the war, or indeed did it have an active role in public consciousness. During the war?
I believe that it happened in twofold. In terms of occupying a space, that the image of black men were seen as stereographed images or stereotypical caricatures. So they were rarely seen as men who contributed to their own freedom. And so the images, for me, were popularized by posing. And that they were the poses were coded in aspects of manhood, and that they became much more popular after the war, shared and reproduced, and used by family members and also in classrooms. So they circulated within black communities, while the images of blacks as dehumanized images of blacks circulated in the larger community. So these images circulated in different spaces. So they occupied, there was a sense of desire for men to be seen as, you know, upstanding citizens and who were part of their freedom. So that's kind of a new way of, you know, new vision.
I mean, I think that's an interesting point, but I think it also speaks to who paid for the pictures and how they were made, because it struck me, looking at the portraits you showed, that most of those were probably made for the soldiers themselves, mm-hmm. And many of them looked to be tintypes or ambrotypes, so they were singular images, and the black soldier would have walked into a studio, handed a person a money, and gotten that picture to take home, and, you know, lucky for you that you later found it in an archive, whereas the stereos, like that Tony showed, were always made for commercial purposes and were always made for wide distribution. So I think you've established two really interesting kinds of photographs, and I think they always had different origins, mm-hmm. I would guess. And that, you know, they're only really being brought together into a single argument right now.
Mm-hmm. And different, I assume, different ways of circulating. I mean, and I guess that's something that touches on everybody's talks about, well, indeed, how did these circulate? I mean, Molly mentioned, of course, propaganda, of course, and I'm, as a good example, certainly, obviously, we know, as Tony raised, the carte de visite is a means for circulation. But the daguerreotype you showed in the beginning, for example, well, how did that have any impact beyond that singular image itself?
Well, Sumner did his best. He wanted to make he had several different poses taken. I've only found one, but he seems to have had more than one taken. And he tried to circulate that one photograph to get it into as many people's hands as he could, but that was the limitation of the mid-1850s rather than having the carte de visite. I found evidence that people then tried to do reproductions of some of these pictures to lesser effect. The crystallotype, I don't know if you're familiar with that, was some way of trying to copy these images, but they were just very limited in the 1850s in terms of what they could do. But in terms of circulation, we know that the photograph was at the Massachusetts State House, that you could come by and look at it, and in letters between Sumner and John Andrew, who was not yet the governor, he says, it's always out. I can't, you know, people are always coming by to look at it, which makes it a really interesting object in itself, that it is something that's of such interest that people are handing it around because they can't really reproduce it at that point.
Well, if we're juxtaposing, for example, when Marnie showed the engravings of the photographs versus the photographs, mm-hmm. Were engravings a means, the lithographs as a mean before the carte de visite was available?
Not for these particular images. I have no evidence that they made any engravings of these images. I don't think they had. I mean, maybe they didn't quite have the appeal of the scorched back or the audience yet. I mean, it was so new, and that Sumner even thought to have her picture made and tried to distribute it was just a new direction entirely, I think. And then the carte de visites that come later, I think those must have come because they knew about this picture, although I don't have any evidence yet. But they knew about this little girl. She toured around. And I guess there's an important dynamic here, at least with those pictures, between the photograph of the children and the children themselves, that one probably reinforced the other, that people would go and see them and then buy their photograph. And we have evidence of that.
Do you think, I don't want to belabor this point, but in light of, let's say, for example, the Amistad, you know, mutineers, and and of course the Jocelyn painting and its reproductions as both engravings, and I find it interesting that the portraits of the children didn't become a the same sort of, you know, rallying, or for that matter, even commercial possibilities, let alone propaganda ones.
There was for the Civil War era carte de visite. So I take that back. There was an engraving made of the whole group.
Uh-huh, right.
Which is in Harper's Weekly.
Right.
That was it. But of the individual portraits, I haven't seen anything. Yeah. But that said, I mean, there were a million copies of these photographs, so someone was buying them.
So, moving into, you know, this question of, I guess, that I'm curious about the changing meanings that Tony demonstrated in authenticity, the questions of authenticity in the carte de visite you show, this question about the language of photography. You made that really interesting point about the sort of language of belatedness that's embedded into the photograph of aftermath. That said, it seems to me that, for example, the photograph of the two kids is carrying some sort of narrative. What that narrative is, obviously, we're finding hard to determine. But I guess that's one of the issues that I'm curious about in terms of the language, and for that matter, the photographs during the war. How much recognizing the stillness factor, the non-motion aspect of this. can we assume that viewers at the time, and maybe the problem is that we can either assume or know, have a certain familiarity about what a still image is and what it portrays that either photographs defy or they are trucking in to some extent, either successfully or unsuccessfully? I guess I'm trying to dig in a little deeper about how much we can divine in terms of what that language is. What, as you were saying, what indeed is the impact of these photographs?
Okay, yeah. Well, probably I think what Marnie says is right on, in that photographs cannot be necessarily understood within the language of photography only to somehow arrive at an understanding of the impact of its language. If we were to compare with other visual cultural elements, and in fact the Civil War is not only a wordy war where people write about it a lot, it's a visual war where people have all kinds of things associated, and not necessarily just photographs, lithographs, drawings, caricatures on musical sheets. It's a very, very visual war. And in that sense, I suppose my reading of the photographs as particularly still and particularly fraught with a kind of motionlessness that is a weighted motionlessness is measured against all this other visual stuff in circulation. You know, there are these Marnie showed some wonderful scenes of the manipulation of what illustrators do to photographs. There are some wild things that are out there. You know, photographs of stilled battlefields or bridges that suddenly in an illustrator's hands have troops marching across bridges, right, and bodies strewn all over the place. And so my sense is that in that comparison, there's a kind of power given to the photograph in precisely its stillness. I suppose too, and this is, and I'm projecting here quite a bit here, right, and it's sort of the art historical imperative, is that in the practice of photography, a photographer is out there on the fields and is laboring, and there is some sense, for those of you who have ever held up a camera, right, that you're after certain kinds of things. And here are photographers who are laboring day after day after day with a sense that they're always late, right? They're always late. and it's not, I don't think for them, it's a debilitating feeling. I mean, that's the practice of photography. But it's a practice of photography that is constantly and always being measured by the other forms of newsworthiness that are being offered to an interested public. What do photographers do? They're not only late, but then they send their images back with couriers to newspapers who then gussy up the images, which only makes their originals seem even later. Because the images are transformed in such a huge way. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question in a way, but yeah, right.
Yeah, sure.
So I think the other thing to remember here is that photography is really new. I mean, we're talking about a period that's only 20 to 25 years after the invention of photography. And we grew up with photographs. When we look at a photograph, we tend to think we understand an array of ways to understand it and to embrace it or to attach stories to it. But I actually, you know, in the 1840s and 50s, just before the Civil War, photographs were sometimes confusing to people. Like, what are they? They can't explain events like prints can. They don't compete with novels. They don't describe a landscape as well as a map or a scientific drawing. So I think what makes the 1860s so interesting here is that this is a moment when people are still trying to figure out how you do interpret these things. And I think you're right, Tony, they're interpreting them, you know, against all these other kinds of things. And I think it's very hard for us to go back and recover that kind of 1860s mindset. I mean, I think the words that are often attached to these pictures are really one of our best clues for getting at how people encountered them in the marketplace. And that's what makes your example so interesting, because different sets of words could be applied to the same picture. You know, for the pictures that you were showing, Deborah, it's so hard to know. I mean, I think we can interpret these poses in a particular way now, but it is so hard to go back to the 1860s and understand what those tintypes meant when people brought them home to their families. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to ask whether any reading of ours is necessarily ahistorical. And if you find a letter that talks about a picture, you're really lucky. But those are really hard to come across.
Yeah, but some of the responses are based on Frederick Douglass's words as well as his the letters. There's a wonderful letter, a book by Pamela Newker, who is looking at letters from Black America, and as they talk about the experience of going to the photography mm-hmm. studio and what they wanted to impart in the posing.
Well, and I like the idea that it's not just us laboring to interpret these photographs, but that these were narratives, stories that people are trying to tell in going into the studio in the first place.
To wear a certain uniform.
Right. Mm-hmm. To pose in a certain mm-hmm. way. And that's true with the propaganda photographs, too, mm-hmm. of course. They're trying to tell, they're very clearly trying to tell a story about mm-hmm. light-skinned slave women in these photographs.
So a significant aspect of this, one could say, certainly, for example, in terms of the personal photograph, is actually the experience of being photographed. I mean that it's new to a great extent, and it's probably a singular event. I mean for many of these people, and I guess in some opportunities, I guess they're traveling photographers. I guess the majority of photographs they took were portraits, or at least that's one argument. But I'm struck by that as an aspect that perhaps hasn't been talked about enough, the subject's experience. Mm-hmm. And indeed, your thoughts about how much the subject controlled the image. I mean, we know that Frederick Douglass was very concerned about that, mm-hmm. but how much this was, I guess you could say, almost like common consciousness.
Not sure.
Right. Yeah, that's for sure. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, there's a way in which one wants to read the photographs as as always already framed by the studio and the lens of the photographer, and therefore to rob the sitter of any kind of agency, and you have to look very very hard for those moments of agency in the photograph. And there are many ways of being able to get at that. Text is certainly one way, but text is not in any way an source or a reliable source itself. Another way is to somehow compare photograph after photograph after photograph and to try to find the tiny changes in a studio's language. And you hope those changes have symbolic meaning, or you hope those changes are the result of a certain kind of agency on the part of the sitter. But even then, it's quite speculative, really. You know, and so it's a matter of really cross-referencing in all kinds of ways. And then, in the art historian, I guess I'm the only art historian here, so I can sort of say this. But if all you're left with then is photographs, there is nothing that prevents you from making claims about it, right? If that's the only record you have, then it cannot remain inert. The option is to have it remain inert, and that's not what we want it to do. You have to sort of make some, you're licensed to make claims on those sorts of things, I think.
Not if you're a historian.
Not if you're a historian, right.
It's a different
license. But here's a letter that was sent back to a man who sent a photograph back to his family. He said he had left his home a slave, but had returned in the garb of a Union soldier, free a man. And that was in the letter that he sent. So in imagining what it meant from becoming the vision of a slave to free and a man. I think that's, I was just looking for one of the letters that I...
Mm-hmm. That's great.
So when are claims, at this point in time, in 2011, getting to 2012, there's an abundance, as we've been discussing, of photographs, and photographs is the authentic image of the war. When are claims about that beginning? I mean, what 10 years after the war? What are the claims vis-a-vis the photographs of the Civil War? What are they 20 years after? Is this a changing? Is this a moving target?
I think it's a moving target. We know that Brady, he ended up selling during an auction. I think the War Department, he couldn't sell it to the Congress, wouldn't buy it, and then the War Department bought a lot. I think it was 2,000 of them. We offered $2,600, and then so it changed each time. Right after the war, he couldn't get anyone interested in the war because everybody wanted it over with and forgotten. And so now we're back again with the value of these images.
The, There's a wonderful moment in the 1890s, and I'm reminded of it regularly because I live in New England, and New England is crazy about this moment in the 1890s where the war is remembered again. Mm-hmm. And if you ever wander through New England towns, you'll come to the commons of every town, and there's the same stupid soldier and a sculpture in every single town, right? And those are all from the 1890s. Mm-hmm. And that's that moment of a recovery of a kind of this, mm-hmm. of this show of nationalism, mm-hmm. Among competing groups of constituents who probably would not have shared much 20 years before. Mm-hmm. And it's at that moment, to answer your question, Josh, that at least in my sense, photographs take on a new life, mm-hmm. again. They take on a very, very big life, and then and become objects of sometimes simple history, but also objects that already wear the patina of a past that really can't be recovered in a way. There were elements of that earlier, certainly, but by the 1890s, that's my sense of the case. Yeah.
But just to pick up on Marnie's point, I mean, I think historians still don't use for photographs in the way that they ought to. They're still sort of illustrations, but they're not really evidence yet. Still, I mean, I think that we're still waiting for that point at which it becomes sort of an integrated whole between text and photograph in the way we understand the war. But I also took from your question, maybe I'm misreading something about the with authenticity questions of whether the photographs themselves were authentic or mm-hmm. staged and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I know, I mean, in the case of these photographs, I mean, people were accusing Mary Botts of being a fake right. in 1850. And that's based on her photograph. So, you know, I don't know. There's trickery from the beginning. We often think of 19th century audiences. I think it's true that a lot of them thought the photograph might have been evidence of the truth. You could do science through photography, that sort of thing. But I think people were also really aware that, just like anything else, it could be an illusion staged for political purposes, and they weren't. Everybody wasn't naive about that, I think.
Even before Photoshop.
Yeah.
I see by the clock on the wall, we should give some time for members of the audience to ask questions and queries.
I'm Elizabeth Hutchinson. I teach art history at Barnard and Columbia. And I'm interested in an issue that I think comes up for art historians that the historians haven't addressed, but gets to this problem that Marnie is raising, and it's the question of genre, right? So the genre of portraiture is very easy one to translate into photography. And so people know how to read a portrait. And they don't necessarily know how to read these other photographs that come out of the Civil War, partially because they don't quite fit any existing genre. We don't know what to call them. Are they history? Are they genre painting? And in fact, when you say that not every kind of picture is made of the Civil War, I think it's partially because the pictures that are made are being influenced by those prints. So we're not only competing with prints, but we're also having prints dictate the kinds of parameters and paradigms that the photographers can act in a way that's legible. So that's, I think, you know, I'm a big believer in Trachtenberg's argument for the sentimentality of the scenes that turn up in the sketchbook being very much creating domestic spaces out of bunkers, mm-hmm. Because we have genre paintings that are all about domestic spaces, and we don't necessarily have an ability in photography to forge new genre that are going to get any traction with viewers. So I think it's a really interesting observation that you're making, and it's also interesting that photography doesn't come into acceptance as a whole. It comes into acceptance in different formats at different paces. But the other thing that I was thinking about as you were talking about subjects control or participation in their portraiture, and forgive me for being very indulgent, but my great-great-great-grandfather ran away from high school to go fight in the Civil War, and he had his picture taken constantly. And the letters that he sent home every 3 or 4 weeks. He grew a mustache, he got a haircut, he got a change in his uniform, he had his picture taken. But for him, it was coming into the Civil War and coming into photographic space were simultaneous. And I think we need to understand that for many of these individuals, they never would have been photographed before the Civil War. And the opportunity to be photographed as a participant in the Civil War is a moment of identity making. And I say this partially because Tony was saying we should look for difference and the individuality of these portraits, but I think for many of these individuals, they want it to look the same. They wanted to look like a soldier, and the opportunity to create a permanent record of them in a uniform, right, matching everybody else with the same stuff, was a moment of self-making that's very different from the way in which we now think about photographs having to distinguish us all as having an individual identity.
That's a good point. Yeah. I guess my pictures are different from everyone's, yes, in that respect, and what I think is interesting about them is that they sort of they use people's expectations about a portrait in order to upend their expectations, right? They sort of, it's this radical use of convention in early photography.
It's very accessible. I mean, if there are manuals about how to understand other genre in the 1860s, we already have Marcus Aurelius Root. We already have a century of comportment manuals that tell you exactly how to pose to look dignified or respectable or maternal or whatever.
Right.
So, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Very legible.
Well, I thought you made a couple of really great points there, and I think you're absolutely right about the absence, or photography's inability to capture particular genres. History painting. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about how wars in American history have been depicted in the past. You can think of the grand, you know, paintings of the death of General Wolfe, or you can think of the elaborate lithographs and paintings of the Mexican War. Whoa. They really came up shorthanded in the Civil War. You just simply couldn't do that with a photograph. So I think you made a good point there. In terms of the portraiture, I think this is another moment where it's really useful to think not just that people understood how to pose for portraits because the manuals are of popular literature, but to think about this moment in the mid-19th century. I mean, this is basically the first time in the history of mankind where you could go away from your family and communicate with your family about what you looked like. So it's something that we see in this country first during the gold rush when people go out to California, and they are ecstatic to be able to send pictures home that make them look like gold miners. Mm-hmm. People go dress up like cowboys because they want to show their family they can look like cowboys. And I think you make a really great point that the Civil War portraits fit into that genre. And I think another opportunity for historians is that nobody has really looked at how sentiment changes at this particular moment. Like, what does it mean to be part of the first generation of Americans that can not only know what a beloved brother or husband or son looks like once they've moved away, but the first generation of Americans who knows what a grandfather who died relatively young in a war looked like. So if there's any graduate students here looking for other projects, I think that's a fantastic one because nobody has looked at the impact of portrait photography on American families at this time, and certainly Civil War pictures provide ample opportunity for that.
I'm Andy Tucker. I teach at the Columbia Journalism School. Hi, Josh. Here's a specific question for my students, from my students. I teach a course, a survey course in journalism history. I show them the Brady Studios photographs of the Civil War era. I show them the posing and the faking and the moving of the bodies on the battlefield. And being good journalism students, they get horrified and upset. You know, my God, they should have been fired. How did people at the time feel about that? Did they know? Did they know to think in those terms? If they knew that these were manipulated photographs, did it upset them? Or was this simply photographs that gave you a sense of what the battlefield looked like and that's what you wanted? I'm not sure, and I would love some thoughts.
Okay. I'll try. Yeah. We're on the realm of interpretation, I think, again. But my sense is that, you know, the reverence for the dead body that might make contemporary viewers a little icky about the manipulation of bodies was not a reverence that necessarily existed in the 19th century. I mean, as an example, there are so many photographs of recently deceased children who've been gussied up in all kinds of ways, right, and who are made to look as if they're reading something or they have just played a game and that there's a kind of life in death and that the studio space becomes a space where the body cannot be necessarily defiled in this movement but manipulated in a particular way. My sense is that had the viewers of, say, Gardner's Sharpshooter's Last Home understood that those bodies, that body had been moved, would not necessarily have been shocked by that mm-hmm. in any particular way. The same for, you know, the series of bodies in the Antietam field where the bodies were lined up, prepared for burial. Mm-hmm. That's clearly a manipulated, organized mm-hmm. scene here. That helps partly answer the question.
It addresses reverence. What I'm still wondering about is the question of authenticity and the expectations of authenticity.
Well, as far as I know, people really weren't sure that those bodies were moved until William Frazzanito published his books in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So I absolutely don't think that 19th century viewers would have been aware, as our students now are, thanks to us, that those bodies have been moved. I think that's only within the last 30 or 40 years that that's been understood.
Yeah, but if they had been.
But I also want to say that none of those bodies are identified.
Yeah.
You can think of all the Civil War dead photographs that you've seen. As far as I know, we can't put a name to a single one.
Huh.
And so that also makes it a different kind of conversation about death and makes it a more metaphoric kind of conversation about death. And I also agree with Tony that death was different. I mean, mm-hmm. people did die at home mm-hmm. in the 1860s, and everybody looking at these pictures would have had intimate experience with dead bodies that few of us do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's another one of those moments where it's very hard to recover that sort of 1860s moment of viewing.
Yeah.
But having said that, the questions I know of authenticity are tied to the Civil War sketch arts,
uh-huh.
and that becomes a very, very big issue for not only readers but soldiers who love the illustrated papers still like to make fun at how inaccurate they are at the time.
Ah.
Or, you know, wrong uniform here, wrong saddle there, or you know, you didn't move into battle that way.
Right.
To the extent to which some, but then the question becomes, well, what does authentic mean?
Yeah.
Because for the pictorial press, the notion is, we were there, that we didn't make this up in the mm-hmm. office. I know of one instance. And this is where one wonders whether this, you know, germinates into another medium of when Alfred Woad, I think it was on the Antietam battlefield, he did a sketch, and there's a battlefield surgery right on, mm-hmm. in the midst of the bodies, and he sketched the amputation with the leg facing the reader, mm-hmm. the viewer. When the engraving was made, the body was turned around, and Woad was really, really pissed.
Uh-huh.
And you know, that actually was a big to-do within at least the home office versus the sketch artist. I don't know if any photographer ever complained about the way the engraving distorted their particular image.
But there are other moments. There's another illustrator named Theodore Davis who talked much later, mm-hmm. I was thinking, and who knows what kind of nostalgia he was talking through as well. But much later he described how he would go about sketching on the battlefield. And he knew that in the course of the events, he could never sketch quickly enough. So he would take these memorandum pages before battle. He would go to the various camps and figure out which general was wearing what uniform and how many stripes they had, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when the battle happened, he would do little stick figures. And afterwards, he would go back and apply what he had learned in the camps onto the stick figures.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a level of I don't want to say authenticity, but there's a level of a sense of eyewitnessing that these things register
mm-hmm.
in a way, and they're not always even in any way. There are certain things that he thinks are worth doing in these so-called memorandum sketches, and some things that we today might think of as necessary for the reality quotient that he doesn't even bother with.
Yeah. I'm a physician, so I've always been very naturally interested in the photographs taken by the medical department about of the soldiers. And I was always wondering about, is there any documentation about how the soldiers felt? I mean, were they just being ordered to do it? Were they proud of those wounds? I mean, some of them, you know, they're still even today very, very shocking photographs. And also, do we know, did their families see these photographs? And these were people who were identified. I mean, they bore names, and so that it wasn't like the war dead on the battlefield who were anonymous.
I don't know the answer to that one.
Most of those are post-war, right? Those photographs?
Yeah.
Post-war, right.
I can't remember the name of, there's a book of images that are identified, and some of the families were familiar with the experience that their sons had with surgery, and just like the scourge back was known as scourge back mm-hmm. for a long time, but, you know, it was identified by Gordon, the name Gordon, and also where he was a where he lived in Louisiana, but some of them are identified. And I'm going to tell you the name of the book in a second, but it's like not. It's, I can yeah. see it, but okay. I can't read it. But it's a really important project. Yeah,
okay.
That a number of people who were in the medical profession focused on identifying the names, the location, the wound, the type of wound, everything.
May I ask a question back, though, from your expertise, though? Having seen a photograph like that, would it be instructive for a medical
student? Yes, I mean, that was, I think at the time, those were really probably the first medical photographs that had ever been taken. So I think of people looking at how wounds and trying to understand what would be the best amputation. I mean, as that was obviously the major surgery. But even internal wounds, I mean, of seeing people about whether, draining the wounds, leaving the wounds open, so a lot of controversy at that time. So I think that they certainly were quite instructive. I mean, that was my understanding, was that was the purpose of taking them, mm-hmm. that to try to instruct physicians about what was trying best practice to understand what were the best practices.
Mm-hmm. Stanley Burns, do you know
his
collection
know.
Also
yes, yeah.
has a strong right. collection of
yes.
images.
I just point out that one of the interesting things about those photographs is while the wounds are bare, they are studio pictures. Frequently the rest of the body is clothed in very nice clothing, in uniform or in a suit.
Right.
They're often sitting next to a table with a tablecloth on it or a vase of flowers. And so all of the conventions of regular portraiture are often, I mean not always, but in many of these pictures, all of the conventions of regular portraiture are there, which can only signal to me that they're trying to preserve the dignity of the sitter, while also encouraging the sitter to understand the purpose of the photograph as having that medical information. But it's not, they're not clinical, you know? And it's sort of like looking at Thomas Aiken's surgery pictures and how they changed. Clinical didn't exist as a style yet, but they definitely have all of the trappings of sort of middle class mm-hmm. sense of self. There's nothing anonymous about the people present, at least the ones that I've looked at.
We'll take one more question.
My name is Glenn Spear. I went to school here in history, and I'm also an old photo editor from the Associated Press, one of the first jobs I had. And this has been fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. And I was particularly interested in what you were talking about, Professor Mitchell, with the photos of the very light-skinned black children, freed slaves. And what that made me wonder about was exactly how were these photos perceived? What does it say about attitudes in the North, particularly Massachusetts, say, about miscegenation, mm-hmm. perceptions of black people, in terms of, we're always asking, well, who's black, who's white, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm curious about.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that what's interesting about that series taken during the Civil War is that it had to have had this sort of two-sided effect in the sense that it sort of raised the sympathies of people, but it also, I think, raised the anxieties of people as well in the North. And there's actually one...
Anxieties
about racial mixture, which
yes.
were, sort of had been building for a long time, but the notion that once everyone is free and there are people that look white but are not, the possibility of them mixing in white society. How is someone going to question your whiteness because you look white? But I mean, so there are actually two photographs in that series. One is of three of the children, and there's a little story underneath it that says these children were expelled from a hotel, I think in Philadelphia, when it was learned that they had been slaves. And I think that sort of story was about telling people both, that's terrible that these children were thrown out, but at the same time, like, who else could get thrown out of a hotel for being, if you're attached to if slavery is attached to your personal story. And then there's one other one that they had made wherein three of those children are posed wrapped in American flags. And I think that one is also trying to in some ways quell that racial anxiety, just to say that these are white-looking children, but they are sort of, this is, that they're emancipated and they're become Americans and it's okay, you know. But I think that these pictures can be read both ways. That it's about ending slavery, and it's also about emancipation. And how do we know how people read those two stories? It's not entirely clear, but suggestions are that they were read in terms of emancipation as well as in terms of slavery.
But it's kind of sad, I thought, in terms of the propaganda that you talked about, which mm-hmm. was interesting to me, that in order for Sumner and the abolitionists in the North to get more sympathy, mm-hmm. you know, for abolitionism and for mm-hmm. slaves, mm-hmm. They're using these very light, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
black children that are passing for white
right.
to try to instigate anti-slavery feeling. And,
right.
you know, I thought that said quite a bit about things as well.
Right. And I so far have not found any sort of commentary to that effect from the 19th century to say, you know, why are we just having sympathy for these children? I haven't found it.
There's actually a print of Sumner walking in the street with a poor white girl coming up to him, and there's a little black girl.
Oh, that's
girl,
right, that's
and,
right.
And
yep.
the poor
right.
white girl saying, why am I not, you know, being treated the way this this black girl is, or words to that effect.
Right, right, so it's sort of reversed.
Yeah,
This thing is reversed. But in terms of the sympathy for whites through these photographs, I haven't seen anything.
Thank you. One more.
My name is Aston Gonzalez. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan. And my question is really simple, I think, in its length. But where are the black photographers? And I'm asking because I think you've all touched on how the photographers of these images really wield a lot of control and power over the subjects, and many other things. But I'm wondering about the artistic production of African Americans in particular, because I know in the 1830s and 40s, they're very involved in creating lithographs, painting, or creating oil paintings, and also, you know, creating daguerreotypes of black and white abolitionists or famous people in Philadelphia and New York in particular. So I'm also thinking about, like, you know, Henry Box Brown and creating panoramas, J.P. Ball's panorama in 1855. Mm-hmm. I mean, African Americans are very, very involved in having a voice, having a say in what ideas are communicated about race at this time. So I was wondering, where are the black photographers, or are there any that we know of?
They, just in terms of the one that I show was Augustus Washington, and his work, he had a studio, but he worked as a photographer as well as an abolitionist. But on the front, there were operators who worked for Brady and not known as photographers, so they were working on the battlefield. But I can't imagine free black photographers going south, moving south to document this. I have not been able to find any, but I have found notices, information about blacks working as operators or working in developing the film and working in that as laborers for photographers. But the two well-known photographers working during the time were working as abolitionists, documenting other abolitionists.
I want to thank the panel.
Thank you.